Okay, so I'm very pleased to introduce a speaker who could have been invited also for talking about auditory, but this shows the convergence between the two systems that we try to illustrate and capitalize upon today. So Steve Lomber is the holder of the Canadian Chair of Brain Plasticity, and he is carrying a program which is mostly focused on cochlear implants, but actually he's also working a lot of interference between the visual and the auditory system. And his title tells a lot about what we are expecting to hear today, which is how we see the world, actually through acoustic experience. So acoustic experience that tells how we see the world. So I'm very happy to have you talk on that today. And again, thanks for coming.
Great. Well, first off, I'd like to thank our hosts for the kind invitation to speak today, and I hope to continue the tradition set by Amir and Shahab for a really interesting and provocative talk so far today. Okay. So for most of us, this is kind of how we view the cerebral cortex or the cerebrum in general. However, when you look at a picture like this, it's incredibly deceptive because you're really only looking at about 5 or 10% of the total area of the human cerebral cortex. To really understand the size of the cortex, you really need to go inside the head, okay, and look at a horizontal section like this. So taking a transverse section through the head here and opening it up, you can see the scalp and the skull, and even in an unprocessed tissue, you can tell the difference between gray matter and white matter. And you can see the depths of the sulci and the gyri, and how deep the cerebral cortex actually goes in towards the center of the brain. And if you take the estimates of Ted Jones and Alan Peters and completely remove all the sulci and gyri and completely flatten the human cerebral cortex, you'd actually end up with an area about the size of a small dining room table. So it's actually a really large structure in terms of the XY plane that's been compacted into a really small space. Another important thing we obviously know about the cerebral cortex is its functional specializations that are really helpful to us as neuroscientists because they've led us to know where things are localized in the brain, like visual processing or auditory processing or somatosensory processing. Obviously, the downside of having such functional specialization is that small regions of focal damage, like a stroke, can have devastating functional consequences. But this morning, I'm going to be talking a little bit about cortical plasticity. And the definition that I tend to use for cortical plasticity is it's changes that occur in the function and organization of the cerebral cortex as a consequence of experience. Right? Now, experience is a very broad term. Right? It can deal with both changes in your sensory world, but obviously changes in your physiology as well. This morning, I'll be talking about it in terms of the presence or absence of sensory input, or the presence or absence of acoustic input or deafness. So for most of us, we kind of encountered cortical plasticity for the first time probably at university, studying the Nobel Prize winning experiments of Hubel and Wiesel, looking at ocular dominance columns. And in these projects, in this case in the monkey, they injected antegrade tracers into the eye, which were then passed forward to the LGN, taken up by the cells here, and transported upward to visual cortex, which you can see here. And they processed, in this case, layer 4 of visual cortex and found this characteristic black and white stripe profile that you find in layer 4, where the white regions were in receipt of projections originated from the injected eye, and the black regions were in receipt of projections coming from the non-injected eye. And this was an interesting result unto itself, this kind of 50-50 distribution, but the really elegant experiment they did was then to raise monkeys with monocular eyelid suture, closing one eye, and then after a period of time doing the exact same pathway injection and finding this pattern, right, where now about 90% of the region of visual cortex was now in receipt of projections from the open or the good eye. And obviously they could then reopen the closed eye and find the projection pattern would go back to this, and this could go back and forth until you reached some period in time which became known as a critical period. And these studies obviously launched thousands of ocular dominance column experiments that have gone on since then. The downside, though, is they also kind of led us to believe that cortical plasticity was really only available early in development, which we now know obviously isn't the case any longer. More recently were some of these elegant experiments performed by Mike Merznick at UCSF on adolescent owl monkeys. So here you can see an owl monkey brain here, obviously anterior and posterior. And what's nice about this is it's a fairly lissencephalic animal. And you can find a nice distribution on the surface of somatosensory cortex of the 5 digits of the hand. Right, so here you see digits 1 through 5 laid out pretty much as you'd expect by, say, laying the hand against the surface of the brain. And they asked the very interesting question of, if this is the normal pattern that you'd find in somatosensory cortex, what happens to this pattern in cortex when you lose a digit? Okay, in this case, by amputation. So they would remove the middle digit or the third digit, and the question was, what actually happens to this representation? Does this area now become devoid of any somatosensory input or stimulation, or what happens? And what they actually found was, after they removed the middle digit, that the flanking second and fourth digits now basically invaded or made use of this underutilized territory, which would normally be devoted to the third digit. And that went along with increased sensitivity of the second and fourth digit, with this increasing cortical territory now devoted to the second and fourth digit. So it was another really elegant example of cortical plasticity. Now, obviously, the Hubel and Wiesel work and this work were examples of competition within a sensory system. So you had competition between the two eyes and the visual system. Here you had competition between the different digits in the somatosensory system. What I'll be talking about today is competition between the sensory systems. And that led us to analysis of what we now refer to as adaptive cross-modal plasticity. And this is the idea that following the impairment of a sensory system, like blindness or deafness, it's the enhanced perceptual performance identified in the remaining sensory systems, or the intact sensory systems, whereby one or more modalities compensates for the loss of another. A classic example of that would be enhanced spatial localization in the blind, which is so elegantly examined by Franco Lepore's group at the University of Montreal. So the general idea we have here is this is a cat brain, which will be the animal we'll be talking about for most of the talk. And this is anterior and posterior. And the regions shown here in yellow are the kind of classic 13 defined auditory areas of the cat's cerebral. Auditory cortex in the cat's actually a very large area. And this area shown here in orange is visual cortex. So the idea of this is the hearing condition, what happens when the animal is actually devoid of normal auditory input? What happens to this large space, which would normally be processing sound, but obviously following deafness is going to be performing other tasks? And we're obviously going to be looking at what sort of contribution this area makes to visual processing as a consequence of hearing loss. So a really important review that came out about 10 years ago really helped guide some of these experiments I'll be talking about today. And this was done by Daphne Bavalier, who's now at the University of Geneva. And in 2006, she did a paper which actually has this exact same title, Do Deaf Individuals See Better? And it was a meta-analysis of all the human psychophysical literature that had been done on congenitally deaf individuals and their visual abilities. And, you know, you might expect, the deaf can't see through walls, or they don't have superpowers like that, but there are specific visual abilities that the deaf are better at compared to normal hearing individuals. And that includes visual orienting and reorienting, visual motion processing, and visual stimulus onset detection. So with this in mind, we tried to construct a battery of fundamental visual psychophysical tasks that we could test in hearing and deaf cats. So the 3 points I hope that I'll make over the course of the next 30 minutes or so is, first off, that congenitally deaf cats have specific visual abilities that are superior to hearing cats and very similar to the abilities found in congenitally deaf humans. That regions of deaf auditory cortex, this would be auditory cortex that would normally be hearing in a hearing animal, are responsible for mediating these enhanced visual abilities of the congenitally deaf. And finally, the cross-modal reorganization of the congenitally deaf switches the sensory, but not the behavioral roles of auditory cortex. This is kind of follow along the task-specific theme that Amir set up earlier today. Okay, so the first experiment, our two aims, were to first determine what visual abilities are enhanced as a consequence of deafness, and secondly, determine what role deaf auditory cortex may play in mediating these superior visual functions. So obviously one of the animals we'll be talking about today is the congenitally deaf cat, otherwise known as the deaf white cat. It has a very characteristic phenotype, generally long or short white hair, and two blue eyes that you can see here. And if you find an animal with this phenotype, it has about a 75% chance of actually being born deaf. And you test this with ABRs, obviously, shortly after birth. And this is myself and Andre Kroll. Andre is my sole source provider of congenitally deaf cats. He's at the Medical University of Hanover. And we've been collaborating now for nearly 15 years on these projects. So for our experimental approach, first off, white cats and hearing cats are born. Deafness and hearing is then confirmed with auditory brainstem responses at 1 month of age. After reaching maturity or at about 1 year, we're going to start training and testing on a battery of visual tasks. We're then going to implant cooling loops, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, over desired regions of deaf or hearing auditory cortex to permit their reversible deactivation. We're then going to test all cats on all tasks during deactivation of each of the cortical loci that we'll be examining. And then at the end, we perform acute electrophysiological recordings and pathway tracer injections, perfuse and process the tissue. So from beginning to end, each animal's going to be participating in about 5 years worth of experiment. Okay, so the first aim, obviously, is to determine what visual abilities are enhanced as a consequence of deafness. So to do this, we're going to psychophysically test both the hearing and the deaf cats on a battery of visual tasks to ascertain what visual abilities are enhanced as a consequence of deafness. So the seven tasks that we examined in the first study were two types of acuity, orientation discrimination, direction of motion discrimination, velocity of motion, the simple detection of movement, and finally, detection across the entire visual field. So to cut to the chase, as you might expect, the vast majority of these tasks, both the hearing cats and the deaf cats, were very similar. But for two specific tasks, that is the detection of movement and detection across the visual field, the deaf cats were specifically better than the hearing cats. So let's look at those two tasks in detail. So the first off is detection of movement. And here, this was done in a two alternative force choice apparatus, where the animal basically was selecting one stimulus over the other, and the stimuli were a field of stationary dots and a field of very, very slowly moving, coherently moving dots. And they obviously had to identify the field that was in motion. And this was threshold expressed in degrees per second. And as you can see, for hearing cats, threshold was around 1.3 degrees a second. But for the deaf cats, threshold was much lower, down around half a degree a second. So the deaf cats could detect much slower moving visual stimuli than the hearing cats could. So this was obviously a performance advantage for the deaf animals. And the other task, detection across the visual field, this was done in an orienting arena where the animal had to stand here in the center. Its attention was drawn to the illumination of a red LED here, and then another LED was flashed somewhere at these peripheral locations. And this polar plot here kind of is presented as if you're looking down on top of the apparatus from above, and is expressed in percent correct. The length of each green line shows performance of the hearing animals, and the red extension shows how much better the deaf animals did. So you can see specifically how here in these peripheral positions, 60, 75, 90 degrees, the animals were much better, but not here centrally. Centrally, they were pretty much identical. We didn't find any sort of left versus right asymmetry. So if we collapse the data and just look at eccentricity, so this is obviously central to peripheral, percent correct, the green bars are performance of the hearing animals, and the red bars are performance of the deaf animals. So you can see specifically how much better the deaf animals were at localizing visual stimuli presented way out in the far peripheral field. Okay, so to summarize so far, we saw that congenitally deaf cats have visual abilities similar to hearing cats on the vast majority of the visual tasks that we examined, but specifically for two of them, that is the detection of movement and visual detection in the peripheral field, we saw the deaf cats have visual abilities that are superior to the hearing cats. So now we wanted to move on and actually determine what role deaf auditory cortex may actually play in mediating these superior visual functions. So to do that, we're going to deactivate specific sites in deaf auditory cortex while the deaf cats perform the visual task for which they possessed enhanced visual abilities. Okay, so the four areas that we were interested in examining in auditory cortex were obviously A1, or primary auditory cortex, the anterior auditory field, or AAF, the posterior auditory field, and the dorsal zone, shown here as DZ. Okay, so to do this, we used a reversible deactivation technique that we actually developed in the lab when I was a graduate student. And here we actually implant this device over specific regions of auditory cortex. And it's basically stainless steel hypodermic tubing that we can shape into whatever position we need for whatever region of the cortex we want to cool. This is actually implanted in the animal and is down here in the circuit. Basically, we use methanol as a coolant. It's pumped through a methanol and dry ice bath, exported down to this, which is chronically implanted on the animal, and then returned this way. So it's a closed loop system, and you obviously make the loop cooler by increasing the velocity of the coolant through the system, or warmer by decreasing the velocity. And basically what you're doing is you're inducing localized hypothermia in a very small region on the surface of the brain to render it synaptically silent. So there are a couple important things you need to know about reversible deactivation. First off, is that when you cool the cortex, you need to reduce the temperature down below 20 degrees Celsius. Because when you do that, you eliminate synaptic transmission, but you don't interfere with underlying axonal transmission. Okay, so you don't interfere with fibers of passage lying below the area you're deactivating. It's highly localized. Deactivation can be induced or reversed within minutes. Each animal serves as its own control. You're going to get both control and experimental data out of the same animals. And then finally, multiple cortical sites can be examined in each animal. So instead of just saying, having one group looking at A1, another group looking at AAF, we actually look at four different areas all in the same population of animals. Okay, this is a picture of loops implanted at time of implant. So you can see we've kind of marked out where primary auditory cortex is, the dorsal zone, AAF, and PAF. So here you can see the loops in place on the cortical surface. This is the edge of the craniotomy over here. Obviously, the silver is the stainless steel tubing. This kind of copper color is the microthermal couple coming down, which is monitoring the temperature at the union of the loop. I got to make a special note of this loop here. This one is actually going down into the sulcus. It will dissect away the surface of the sulcus. You can implant the loop down into the sulcus. And we've applied a heat shielding compound to the anterior side of this loop. So we're only going to cool the posterior side of the sulcus and not the anterior side of the sulcus. Okay, so these are thermal reconstructions done just prior to perfusion. Here you can see the exact same four loops that we saw back in this picture, but it's just a line drawing. And each one of these dots is where we inserted a temperature monitoring electrode. So that's what these polygons here are based on. So we went down about 750 microns to record the temperature. Here's the scale here. Remember, 20 degrees Celsius is the important thing. So everything below or in these darker blue regions would be deactivated. So here you can see, let's say for this AAF loop, how well localized the deactivation was. On each one is going to be kind of a halo or parenchyma of partial deactivation around the outside of it. But then you can see how quickly the brain returns to normal temperature. So it's actually quite focal here or quite focal here for the PAF or for the DZ loop as well. Okay, so with that in mind, we implanted, obviously, four loops bilaterally in each animal, so there are eight loops total, right? Four loops in this hemisphere, four loops in the other. And on this task, we're going to deactivate all four areas simultaneously to start. So if we deactivate each one of these four areas, what we find is that the red bar is performance of the deaf animals, and the blue bars are performance of the deaf animals when all four areas are simultaneously cooled. And you can see here the performance specifically drops way out here at the far peripheral representation, 60, 75, 90. So once we saw that we had some sort of deficit, we then went and did individual deactivations of each one of these four areas. So here you can see the same data shown for bilateral deactivation of PAF, DZ, A1, and AAF. And what you'll see is everything's pretty much normal for most of these sites, except for the posterior auditory field. And when you look at the posterior auditory field, you see the exact same drop in performance that we saw when we had all four areas deactivated simultaneously. And in fact, the bilateral deactivation of PAF can completely account for the deficit we saw when we deactivated all four areas. But the neat thing is when you look at the comparison. Okay, so here you can see, obviously, this same data plotted this way. The green bars are performance from the hearing animals. The red bars are performance from the deaf animals. And the blue bars are performance of the deaf animals when the posterior auditory field was bilaterally deactivated. So here you can see that the advantage the deaf animals had went away when we specifically deactivated this region of auditory cortex. So once again, you see that drop down to normal performance levels. So the question is, why PAF? What was so interesting about the posterior auditory field? Well, in hearing animals, when you bilaterally deactivate the posterior auditory field on this task, but instead of using a visual stimulus, you use an acoustic stimulus, what you find here is the animals are completely disrupted for sound localization. So in the hearing condition, what you find is that when you bilaterally deactivate this area, you have a deficit in acoustic localization performance. Now, in the deaf animals, what you're finding is you're having a deficit on visual localization performance. So this area is performing a very similar kind of task, that is stimulus localization, but in the deaf condition, it's doing it visually, in the hearing condition, it does it acoustically. Okay. If we look at the detection of movement task, once again, we're going to deactivate all four areas simultaneously. Okay. So here you can see performance of the deaf animals when everything's warm, and then we cool all four areas, and you see performance rise, or threshold go up to around 1.4 degrees a second or so. So once again, now we're going to deactivate each one of these four areas individually. And what you find here is, once again, each one of these four areas is pretty much the same except for one. But it's not the one we saw before. It's not the posterior auditory field. In this case, it's the dorsal zone. And when you just deactivate the dorsal zone bilaterally, what you find is that performance goes up, and it's no different from the rise in performance we saw when we deactivated all four areas simultaneously. So obviously, this now makes the dorsal zone the interesting place. So what do we know about the dorsal zone? Well, at the time when we did this, let's do the comparison first, getting ahead of myself. So once again, this is hearing performance shown in green, performance of the deaf animals shown in red, and this is performance of the deaf animals when the dorsal zone was bilaterally deactivated. Once again, you can see a threshold go up to levels no different from that of hearing animals. So basically, by bilaterally deactivating the dorsal zone, we're eliminating the advantage the deaf animals had. Okay, so what's so special about the dorsal zone? Well, when we did the study, we didn't know much about the dorsal zone, but since then what we've done is we've done a fairly complicated experiment looking at direction of acoustic motion discrimination. So we've been having the animals in the same arena basically discriminate leftward versus rightward motion moved across arrays of five speakers. Okay, say moving from left to right or from right to left. And what we find is when we deactivate the dorsal zone bilaterally, when they're performing this task, they have a big acoustic motion deficit. So obviously the dorsal zone plays an important role in acoustic motion processing in hearing animals, but now we're finding it's playing an important role in visual motion processing in the deaf animals. Okay. So to summarize, what we found is that when we deactivated the posterior auditory field, we got a visual detection in the peripheral field deficit. But when we deactivated the dorsal zone bilaterally, we got a deficit on detection of movement tasks, but not vice versa. So what we actually found was a visual double dissociation in what would normally be auditory cortex in a hearing animal. Okay, so these areas are obviously cross-modally reorganized and are now making contributions to the enhanced visual functions found in the congenitally deaf. So we've identified the neural substrate underlying these enhanced visual abilities. And this has led to what we call now the supermodal hypothesis. And the supermodal hypothesis is that cortical areas that have been physiologically reorganized in response to a sensory loss, such as deafness or blindness, will be involved in behaviors that are similar to those of hearing or sighted subjects, but mediated by the replacement modality. Okay, so that is that the areas of the brain are performing a similar task, but now we're just substituting one sensory modality in for another. Okay, so since we performed that original study, and we were basically looking at spatial or motion-type tasks, we've now gone on to look at slightly more cognitive functions and the presumptive ventral or what pathway in auditory cortex. So in the cat, the presumptive what pathway starts here in A1 and passes down to A2 into IN and area T, heading down here towards the temporal pole. So we wanted to investigate the role of these four areas in more visually cognitive-based tasks. So to do that for the second study, we had two aims, which are very similar to the aims of the first study. First off, to determine if the learning or recall of any visual discriminations are enhanced as a consequence of deafness. And then we're going to determine what role deaf auditory cortex may play in mediating any superior cognitive functions. So now we're going to look at learning and recall of visual discriminations. Okay, so the experimental approach was very similar. We're going to start with the animals being born. We're going to confirm hearing and deafness with ABRs. After reaching maturity, we're going to train them on the learning and recall of different classes of visual discriminations. We'll then implant cooling loops, test all the animals on their discrimination abilities, perform electrophysiological recordings and pathway tracer injections, perfuse and process the tissue. Okay, so the first aim is to determine Determine if the learning or recall of any visual discriminations are enhanced as a consequence of deafness. So to do this, we're going to test both the deaf and the hearing cats on a battery of visual discriminations to ascertain if the learning or recall of any of these visual discriminations are enhanced as a consequence of hearing loss. Okay, so the seven different types of discriminations we looked at in this task were two different types of patterns, or two-dimensional, simple and complex, then three-dimensional objects, simple and junk, natural scenes, and then finally faces, con-specific, that would be cat-on-cat, or human faces. And these would all be done in a two alternative force choice apparatus. Okay, so in the cat world, patterns such as these, such as shapes, geometric objects, these sorts of letters, would be considered simple patterns, okay, for them to learn to discriminate. Obviously, they'd be novel and so forth. Down here, if you've had any experience with cats, all you have to do is present some sort of distraction to make life harder for them, and that's either done with some sort of outline like this, or some sort of masking pattern like this. Makes it much more difficult for them to learn. Okay, so for the next series of slides, we're going to be looking at performance expressed in terms of errors to criterion. So criterion was set at 90% correct on two consecutive days. And errors to criterion were the number of mistakes they made in order to achieve criterion. So here you can see that for, say, hearing animals, for this, in each set of histograms is going to be one pair of stimuli that they learned. Okay, so this will be one pair, this will be one pair, and so forth. So here you can see the height of the histogram is average errors to criterion for the group of four animals that were tested, and each dot is performance for each individual animal. But what you see overall and generally here is that for both the simple patterns and the complex patterns, there wasn't any difference in learning performance for the two groups of animals. They're very, very similar. Then we went on to simple objects, and simple objects were just three-dimensional black wooden children's blocks. And they had to discriminate the difference between these two. And then we also did junk objects as well, things like this. Obviously, at the average university, you have a lot of wine bottles laying around, so they were a lot of stimuli. But these are the kind of things they had to learn to discriminate. But also very similar, even when we went to objects, like simple objects or junk objects, although they learned them faster, you'll see that instead of around being 40 or 50, now it's down around 30 or so. There was no difference between the hearing and the deaf animals. Then we went on to natural scenes, like beach scenes or fall foliage or mountain scenes, whatever it might be, and we didn't see any difference in learning performance between the deaf and the hearing animals either when we looked at different stimuli. But everything changed when we got to faces. Okay, so obviously faces, we had them learn novel pairs. These would be faces of cats or humans that they'd never seen before. So these are actually two different cats. It's not hard for a cat to figure that out. It might take you a little while. And these are two faces of very handsome men. Okay. So now if we look at how they did with faces, you'll see that there was a big difference in their ability to learn faces. Okay, whether it was conspecifics or human faces, the deaf animals learned in generally about half the number of errors to criterion that the hearing animals did. And that was consistent across the different pairs that were examined. Okay, so you can see that here for obviously discriminating two cat faces or for two human faces. Okay, but this difference was not seen when we looked at recall. Okay, once they learned the discrimination and then came back later and we examined their recall, recall was excellent for all the patterns and objects and even for the faces. So it didn't matter once they learned to discriminate, say, two cat faces or two human faces. They had no problem recalling. The difference was found in their ability to learn to tell the difference between two stimuli. Okay, so this was recall. This is not learning. Okay, so to summarize, the congenitally deaf cats have learning and recall abilities similar to the hearing cats on the vast majority of the discriminations we learned, but the congenitally deaf cats have learning but not recall abilities superior to hearing cats for the conspecific faces and for the human faces. Okay, so now we want to determine what role deaf auditory cortex may play in mediating these superior cognitive functions. So to do that, we're going to perform similar types of deactivations that we did in the first study of regions of deaf auditory cortex while the deaf cats perform the visual discriminations for which they possess these enhanced cognitive abilities. Okay, the difference here, though, is we're going to examine these four areas here, right? A1, A2INNT. Okay, here you can see the cooling reconstructions that were done. So obviously they also got four loops in each hemisphere, but here you can see the reconstruction for A1, for A2, for IN, and for T. Okay, so let's look at some of the data. Now, if you remember from before, this is the type of performance we were finding when there was no cooling deactivation. Okay, so this was the ability of the deaf cats and the hearing cats to learn to discriminate conspecific faces and human faces. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to deactivate all four areas simultaneously and look at the ability of the deaf cats and hearing cats to learn novel faces. Okay, so what you see here is when we deactivate all four areas simultaneously, that the advantage that the deaf cats has now gone away. Okay, they no longer have the fast learning that we saw when they were looking back here when there was no cooling deactivation. Okay, so when we deactivate these four areas, their advantage goes away, and their performance is now no different from the hearing animals. And it didn't matter whether it was the conspecific faces or the human faces, it was the same result. So now we're going to do, like we did before, individual deactivations of each one of these four areas. Bilateral, A1, A2, IN, and T. Okay, so when we do this, what you'll see is the normal kind of pattern shows up when we bilaterally deactivate A1. The normal kind of pattern shows up when we deactivate A2, and the normal kind of pattern shows up when we deactivate IN. But when we specifically cool area T, that's this region down here, when we cool this area bilaterally, you see that the advantage goes away. Okay, so there doesn't seem to be much of a role for these three areas, but specifically for area T, it's playing some sort of critical role in this advantaged face learning that the deaf animals had. Obviously, this was for conspecific faces. We found the exact same pattern of results for human faces. Okay, so obviously this is A1, the normal kind of pattern, A2, the normal kind of pattern, and IN, the normal kind of pattern. Once again, the advantage the deaf animals has goes away when we bilaterally cool area T. Now, one of the advantages we had, obviously, is since we had loops in each hemisphere, we could not only do bilateral deactivations, but we could do unilateral deactivations. So to actually look if there's any sort of hemispheric asymmetry. So here, if you look specifically for conspecific faces, right, when we cool bilaterally, you see that the advantage goes away. For conspecific faces, when we cool just the left area T during learning, you see that the advantage goes away. But that's not the case when we specifically cool right area T. When we only cool right area T, their performance seems pretty normal. So not only is it localized to area T, it's specifically localized to area T of the left hemisphere. So why would that be interesting? Well, if you look at what hearing animals do or what area T does in hearing animals, we've looked at their ability in hearing animals to discriminate tones, noise, and conspecific vocalizations. So that would be meows. Okay, so obviously this would be a discrimination of tones, narrowband noise, and meows. And what you find there is whether you do area T left, bilateral, or right, there's no deficit on tone discriminations. Left, bilateral, or right, no deficit on noise discriminations. But for vocalizations, if you cool bilaterally, you get a really large deficit. And if you cool just the left side, you get a partial deficit different from normal, but not down to chance. And if you cool the right hemisphere, you don't get a deficit at all. So it looks very similar to the kind of deficits you get with vocalizations. So the interesting thing here is in hearing animals, area T is contributing to vocalization discriminations, but now in the deaf animals, area T is contributing to face discriminations. So we'd like to think about area T as an area critical for discriminating individuals, whether that be visually or acoustically. Okay, so to summarize the second part, bilateral deactivation of area T eliminates the faster learning of conspecific and human faces identified in the deaf compared to hearing animals. These enhanced face learning abilities were further localized to area T of the left hemisphere. Left area T in hearing cats is critical for discriminating conspecifics acoustically via vocalizations, while left area T in deaf cats is critical for discriminating conspecifics visually via faces. Finally, the crossmodal plasticity identified in area T reveals a cortical region that may be critical for discriminating individuals. Okay, so hopefully the three points I've made from looking at these two studies is that first off, congenitally deaf cats have specific visual abilities that are superior to hearing animals. Second, regions of deaf auditory cortex are responsible for mediating these enhanced visual abilities. And third, cross-modal reorganization in the congenitally deaf switches the sensory but not the behavioral roles of auditory cortex. Okay, so I need to thank my longtime collaborators on these projects, Andre Kroll at the Medical University of Hanover and Alex Meredith at Virginia Commonwealth University. I need to thank everybody in the lab who's doing all the hard work while I get to go to Paris. And if you have any questions or anything, our website is cerebralsystems.ca and my email address is here. Once again, thank you very much, and I'd be happy to take any questions.